Welcome to Inside Personal Growth Podcast. Deep dive with us as we unlock the secrets to personal development, empowering you to thrive. Here, growth isn't just a goal, it's a journey. Tune in, transform, and take your life to the next level by listening to just one of our podcasts. Well, welcome back to Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of Inside Personal Growth. And we have joining us from, actually, you are living the same place that Guy Kawasaki is, Woodside.
Maybe 5,000 other people. Yeah, it's a town near Palo Alto, California, in the Bay Area. So it's
Pleasure. And we're going to be speaking about this new version. This is revised and updated. What version is, how many times have you revised this?
Well, that's what you have in your hand is the glorious final edition. It came out about 6 weeks ago, and it's the fifth edition. And through all the editions, it's sold over 1 million copies. It's been translated into over 20 languages, but it's got a fascinating history to it. I remember in the early 80s, I had Apple co-founder Steve Jobs as a speaker at one of the conferences I produced. And I said, what motivated you to start Apple? And he said, we make what we want for ourselves. And back in the mid-70s, I wanted a personal computer, but there wasn't one around that satisfied me. So I put myself in a position of co-founding Apple. And, the rest is history. And similarly, in the early 80s, I'd been in business for myself about five.
Let me get that straight. Were you actually a co-founder of Apple at that time?
No. He was a speaker at an innovation and industry conference. I produced seven of those in the early 80s, and he spoke at the first one, but at one of our meetings before then, I asked him that, and he said, we make what we want for ourselves. And so at that point, I'd been in business for about 5 years as a creativity consultant, working with companies to stimulate creativity in various departments, R&D, marketing. I developed a lot of creativity ideas, and I thought I'd love to have a creativity book that was fun, that was interesting, that was interactive, that jumped out at people, was full of pictures and exercises and examples. And I couldn't really find one around. And so, as Jobs had said, we make what we want for ourselves. I created the first edition of A Whack on the Side of the Head. And I did that in 1982. So we're going back 42 years. And I sent it off to publishers in New York, and I got rejection notices from all of them, all nine that I sent it to. So I said, look, I can do this. I have an illustrator I work with. I've got a good distribution network. I'm tied into Silicon Valley. So I self-published A Whack on the Side of the Head in November of 82, and I did a first printing of 2,000 copies, and those sold out in a week, and then I printed 5,000 more. And then 25,000 more. And by March, I'd sold a lot of copies. And so that got the interest of publishers in New York. So I went to New York in the spring of 83 and met with Bill Schenker at Warner Books and Peter.
The rest is history.
Yeah. And so they did that. They bought it. Warner Books did. And as they said, they did a first printing of 100,000 copies. And as I said, it's sold a lot since then. So, but through the years, they allowed me to change it and update it and revise it.
Well, I want to tell my listeners, you are certainly have the ability to help people innovate, and you've done it for many different companies. I think you said you were at IDEO as well, and I want to show my listeners some of the little toys you've created to help people kind of get in a creative spirit and a creative toy. So you can get this book, obviously, at Amazon. You can go to Roger's website as well, which we'll put a link to as well. The book is, like I said, this is a revised edition, and there's a creative whack pack, as he calls it, and ball of wax as well. Tell us if you would, because I think the listeners would be really interested. This book is well documented. You got a great biography in it. You got great stories. You got opportunities for people to get unstuck. What are some of the things you've found over the years through being at IDEO and being close to Apple and all the stuff in Silicon Valley that helps people get unstuck and become more creative?
Let me just correct one thing. I know a number of people, or used to know a number of people at IDEO, but they've never been a client. But but I've worked with many other companies from Apple, IBM, Procter & Gamble, NASA, the Federal Reserve Bank, and on and on. I guess remember to give a couple of my favorite ways to get into a creative frame of mind. One is, don't fall in love with ideas. Don't fall in love with ideas. And that's really, really important thing. People tend to have an idea, fall in love with it, and then use it everywhere, even in places where it's not appropriate. And I'll tell you a quick background story. When I first started in business for myself, 40 plus years ago, I went to a variety of people, said, what's it going to take to be successful in business? And I went to coaches, ministers, business people. And the best advice I got came from my printer. And what he said was, don't fall in love with type styles. And he said, I've seen it happen with a number of designers where they fall in love with a particular typeface, and then they want to use it everywhere, even where it's inappropriate. Well, I didn't listen to him, but pretty soon I fell in love with Palatino semi-bold. And after a while, my design was hackneyed and lacked freshness. So I was able to generalize that idea to don't fall in love with ideas in general. And I found that whenever I've been writing, especially in a book, whenever I've been blocked in a chapter or in a story, it's because I've been in love with a particular example or a particular phrase. And as soon as I allowed myself to get rid of that, beloved idea, things started to flow. And I think Mark Twain hit the nail on the head when he said probably life's most overvalued pleasure is sexual intercourse. And one of life's least appreciated pleasures is defecation. I mean, there's something about letting go that allows new things to happen. So I think that's important. But it's hard to do. It's hard to let go of your favorite ideas. This ties into another really important point, and that is there are two sides of the creative process. There's a constructive side and a destructive side. The constructive side is fairly easy. You come up with new ideas, new strategies, new approaches, new ways of doing business. We do that all the time. The hard part is letting go of what worked for you last year, last month.
What you're using now. Yeah.
And it's hard for me as well. I mean, I have my own beloved ideas, but it's good to examine those. So that would be one thing I would pass along to your many 10,000, 100,000,
listening audience. Whoever's listening today, you never know what the number is going to be, and it's not today. It's when this actually airs. Now, you listed 10 mental locks that hinder creativity. And look, I've been here. I've been stuck many times before, Roger, on, trying to rethink something. And as you said, don't get in love with an idea. Because, if everybody was buying ideas and they bought your idea, everyone would be a millionaire. The reality is you got to implement it. You got to go through the process of the whole creative cycle. Which of these do you find out of this 10 mental locks is what most people struggle with the most? And what advice would you have for kind of overcoming it?
Some of the mental locks, I would say, first of all, we don't need to be creative for most of what we do. I mean, if you got up this morning and started contemplating the bristles on your toothbrush or questioning the meat toast, you wouldn't make it to work. You wouldn't get anything done. So you don't need to be creative for 95% of what you do. A second thing that gets in the way of people being more creative is that we become prisoners of familiarity. We've been prisoners of familiarity. And that means the more often you do something the same way again and again and again, the more difficult it becomes to think about doing it in any other way. You get into these routine thoughts. And the third is that we really haven't taught to be creative as we grow up. And I think most of us have grown up with certain attitudes and beliefs that make sense for a lot of what we do, but get in the way. And these mental locks, which is really what the book is about, include things such as there's one right answer, don't be foolish, to err is wrong, that's not my area. I think for me personally, the creative strategy I use to get out of or to get myself a creative frame of mind, in addition to not falling in love with ideas, is look for the second right answer. Some people get stuck that there's always one right answer, and you do certain math problems, and that is in fact the case. But I think it's important to look for the second right answer, for the third right answer. For example, here's a pen. What is this? It's a writing device. That's the first right answer. What's the second right answer? It's a hole punch. It's an ear cleaner. It's a weapon. As somebody's choking, it could be an emergency tracheotomy device. And if you have that attitude at looking at the world or looking at your own problems, you say, this is the way I solved it last week or last month, but what's the second right way of doing it? What's the third right way? An easy way to enforce this kind of thinking, or this approach in your thinking, is to change the way you ask questions. A lot of people, you may have a boss or a friend or a spouse who will say, what's the result of this? Or what's the answer? Or what's the point? As though you're looking for one answer, one point, or one result. But if you can train yourself to look for or ask questions to solicit plural answers, like, what are the answers to this? You've given me one, give me two more, give me five, give me six. And when you ask people to go beyond the first right answer, they'll typically give you the stock answer or the stock approach. But if you get to the third and fourth and fifth right answer, then you get yourself in a place where you can be creative. And maybe a lot of these won't work. They're impractical. That's another value. You got to be practical. But when you're generating ideas, it's important to look at five and six and maybe 10 if you can. And that's where creativity really starts to open up. So you asked initially, what are some tips for, the listeners here? I would say, don't fall in love with ideas. And another one is, look for the second right answer. The 19th, 20th century French philosopher Emile Chartier once said, nothing is more dangerous than an idea when it's the only one you have, because if you have a problem, you're going to go right to that. That may have solved the problem 2 years ago or 5 years ago or last week, but maybe conditions have changed. And so it's important to keep looking for additional right answers. You don't always have time to do that.
Roger, and I also think in the world in which we live today with AI and the computers, now obviously AI is relatively new to most people, but the ability to have it help you formulate, let's just call them ideas. I mean, look, you're looking at a vast array of knowledge that exists inside this machine that our minds just don't experience or have. How do you think AI is going to affect, or positively affect, I should say? I think it already has. We're seeing it in medicine. We're seeing it in all kinds of areas where it's actually accelerating processes for us to do. I don't want to exclude the fact that as human beings, we are part of the process. Can you outline for me what you think the good part will be and possibly what the downside might be?
Well, you've already outlined a couple of the ones, like a neighbor who is involved in medical fields and doing research, and he's talking about how he's using AI to think of going beyond the first and 10 and even 20 right answers on a particular approach, looking at some DNA solutions, finding, hundreds of thousands of answers and then sorting them out. So I certainly see that in medicine. I think I'm with the vast majority of people who have just been awestruck by how quickly the AI explosion has hit us in the last year and a half, and it seems to be accelerating. And, I see a lot of possible positive uses for it. I mean, I can remember 50 years ago, I worked for IBM, and, it was a great company then, and they were getting resistance. We were getting resistance from companies like, oh, we don't want to be taken over by computers. And we were we learned to sell to them, saying that it will solve a lot of your problems, financial, inventory, invoicing, payroll, and on and on. And then since then, you know, the last, 50 years, computers can do many things. So I don't have any slick answers for you on what IBM's going to do. I think a lot of it's hyped, but I think there's going to be a lot of good applications. Me personally, one thing I feel good about with this recent edition of A Whack on the Side of the Head, and that is, I guess, there we go, is that no AI went into creating it, neither the illustrations nor the writing of it. And I think that, if you've got a program or a set of programs, giving you prompts and giving you outlines how to do things, how to deal with telephone solicitors or deal with the IRS or how to file a complaint, with United Airlines, that can be a good thing. But I think there's still going to be a value for people who can write cogent paragraphs and pages of English and to express their ideas and learn how to do their own thinking. There's nothing quite like writing to find out, what your own ideas are. And it's
I think there's also this element of the way our brain works. We've got a subconscious, especially when you're writing a goal or a vision or something for yourself. The connection between the subconscious and the hand on paper is huge. It's really a big element that people need to take a look at. Hang on a second. And what I would say is that, that is... There is nothing like our own human brains, but to have it be augmented with AI is a really good opportunity. Now, one of the things I know you've done is you've said, hey, you used to put on these events, you used to travel the world, you spoke to all kinds of groups, you were everywhere. And as a result of that, you got some pretty high profile clients. What did you do or could you advise people listening today that were some of the common challenges that those companies face in fostering creativity that many of our listeners right now could be facing? And what did you do to help these companies navigate these challenges that they were experiencing?
Oh, okay. Well, that's a huge,
huge question.
often I was brought in, say a company might have a six-month project that they were working on, or a year-long project, or a re-engineering project. And I'd often be brought in to deal with a group at the very beginning of that to open up people's thinking so that they wouldn't immediately go to past solutions on how to solve, how to manage a project more effectively, or how to develop, this product. So typically, I would be brought in early on to open up people's thinking. And I would share my creativity ideas. We'd often do work in a workshop fashion. And the way I would do my workshops is I think you improve your ability to be creative not by being lectured at. You do it by doing it. And so I would do a lot of exercises, both individual and group exercises, some dealing with problems way out in the blue and some very focused in on, what the company's issues were. And as the day or half day or 2 days would go on, it become more and more focused. If I could share a couple things here on that, you mentioned you wanted several tips, and I've mentioned so far, look for the second right answer and don't fall in love with ideas. One of my favorite ways to get into a creative frame of mind is humor. I found that if you can make fun of a problem, make fun of an organization, make fun of your clients, whatever, it frees your thinking up from a lot of deeply embedded assumptions. And I've seen this happen again and again where early on with a client, I'd have them make offbeat and irreverent mottos for their company, for their products or companies as a way of freeing up their thinking. And I'll share just a couple of those with you that are fun. I think it's important to, go ahead and be wacky, get into a crazy frame of mind and ask what's funny about what you're doing. And again, a lot of people, especially business people, can get really serious. Like, we got a lot of money on the line here. We don't want to lose our customers. We got competition. But if early on in the creative process, you can use a little humor, it really does it. For example, and I'll mention a few of the companies that where I've done this and some of my favorite mottos. Done a few things with Disney over the years, and their offbeat an irreverent motto for Disney was the Walt Disney Company, the place where when you wish upon a star, we charge you for it. And there's
that's certainly true.
Or Microsoft, we're arrogant and we should be. Or Bank of America worked with, well, did a lot of work with the Bank of America over the years. And their offbeat irreverent motto was, where you're not alone until you want a loan. the IRS has been a client, and their motto was, this is, again, created by their own people. The IRS, service is part of our name. Just remember, it's the last part.
Well, you know, it's, you're getting people to be playful. And I think creativity comes from play. And I had this, you've heard this statistic, and so have my listeners, so many times. Between the ages of 1 and 5, our levels of creativity, and maybe I was reading it in your book, they're like off the wall. But then we get programmed through the systems, and we lose our ability to create so much more. I don't know, you probably know the exact statistics and numbers, but I will tell you, it is phenomenal the level of deprogramming that goes on after the age of 5 to actually be creative. Do you want to kind of address that? Because that's really the problem we're addressing, is, well, we got stuck in a system.
Well, you know, again, we don't need to be creative for most of what we do, and you do need to learn how to do math and read and have a lot of practical skills. But I remember when I was a sophomore in high school and my English teacher put a chalk dot up on the blackboard, you know, about the size of a penny, and asked, you know, the class of, I guess we were all 16 years old, what that was. And we said, it's a chalk dot on the blackboard, and nobody say anything else. And then about a minute later, she followed that with the comment, well, that's interesting. Yesterday, I did that same exercise with a group of kindergartners, and they thought of 50 different things it could be. It could be an owl's eye. It could be the top of a telephone pole. It could be a squash bug. It could be all these things. So between the ages of 6 and 16, we had learned how to get the right answer. We'd learned how to be logical and practical. But we'd also lost a fair amount of our imaginative power. And the thing that I've noticed about creative people is that, I can't say this about all creative people, but a lot of them, you know, have good senses of humor, and they're playful, and they allow themselves to fool around with ideas and manipulate them. And, you know, as I would do in my seminars, I'll share just a few others. NASA, I've done probably 5 or 6 things with NASA over the years. Their offbeat motto was, NASA, we get it up. What are a few others? Kimberly Clark, which is a paper products company, and theirs was, we've got a product for every hole in your body. Out in the computer for, if you wanted support, you should have bought Jockey. Anyway, you know, if you can be irreverent with your own, you know, most hallowed ideas and basic beliefs, you know, it opens your mind up. And if I can continue answering this question for you in a little broader way, what I would do with companies and what I also recommend, I mean, a whack on the side of the head gets into that. But over the last, I don't know, nearly half century, I've had a chance to work with a lot of creative people and individuals in a variety of industries and disciplines. And I've noticed a common pattern in how creative people would be able to generate and manage and apply new ideas. The hallmark of creative people is their mental flexibility. They're able to move in and out of different types of thinking depending on the needs of the situation at hand. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes they'd be open and probing and curious and looking all around. And sometimes they'd be off the wall and playful and, you know, irreverent. But when it came time, they were able to be serious and discerning and fault-finding. And then finally, when it was necessary to implement an idea, they would be aggressive and persistent in trying to reach their objective. And so these 4 different ways of thinking, I gave the names of creative people who are able to be an explorer, an artist, a judge, and a warrior. You know, again, mm-hmm. Explorer, artist, judge, and warrior. And so a lot of what I would do in my seminars is to rekindle with participants, and also this happens in the book, or the books and the various products I've created, you know, to tap into your explorer again and be curious and look in places you haven't looked in a long time. And, you know, you even haven't even considered of looking, and you'll expect unexpected things. And it's the artist to, you know, be off the wall, a little crazy, and be foolish and humorous, and, you know, look for a lot of right answers. And as the judge, you know, to be serious and critical, but also build up off of, you know, some of the odd ideas. And then finally, to be the warrior, and that is, you know, get your idea into action. And I would develop these skills with people, have them recognize their own creative ability or their creative style. And, you know, it's important. Some people...
Would you call those, Rogers, kind of the archetypes of people for in that area? Or are these just, what do I call, labels that you put on?
Why? You call them creative archetypes. I mean, I wrote a whole book about it. My second book was called A Kick in the Seat of the Pants, Using Your Explorer, Artist, Judge, and Warrior, you know, to be more creative. And the latest edition of Whack in the Side of the Head has, you know, a lot of that material in the back of using the four rules. And, you know, the thing I would tell people is that some people get stuck in one or two roles all the time, especially at work. You get stuck as the judge, and someone brings an odd idea to you and say, that stinks, it sucks, or suck at work, as opposed to say, well, hey, what if we applied a creative no to that? What if we look for something, you know, a little better on that? Or that's an interesting idea, but maybe it's an idea that would have worked better 3 years ago and that, you know, life has moved on. Or a lot of people, especially salespeople, can get into this world. They're always in warrior mood, you know, like, I got to get out, do the sale, and that's what they're getting paid to do. But if you can open up their explorers and their artists, you know, to, you know, consider some alternative closing approaches or ways to find customers, that would be to their benefit as well. So,
I think that as somebody who's as creative as you've been and help others be coming creative, I'm sure my listeners would love to hear a couple stories about businesses that you work with where maybe some irrelevant or odd idea turned out to be some groundbreaking solution. Because, you know, what I find is what's relatable for me is when an author or a thought leader tells a story of what happened, it actually clicks something in my brain. It's like there's something that fires. Because stories are so compelling. So I'd love for you to tell a story or two about, you know, clients you work for, things that happen, and really an example of how it just became a total breakthrough.
Well, I guess one example, a few years ago, working with a pretty large semiconductor company, and it was... a group working on a project, and they had an 8-month timeline, and you had the engineers there, but also the marketing people. And at the beginning of the project, everybody had their agendas, how they were going to go about doing it. And we were able to break down the various issues and eventually got some marketing and engineering, you know, the marketing representing what the customers, what the clients wanted, you know, out in the field and what engineering was capable of doing. Getting them to talk to each other and eventually getting that product, that project managed in significantly less time. Some other examples, sometimes you can have a successful session where you realize that you've already solved the problem. You hadn't even realized it, or maybe this is what the customer wanted, or maybe you're spending too much time, you know, in some of the, you know, some of the places that I've been talking about, like being the explorer and the artist. Those would be, you know, those would be a few things where I've done that. I've helped some companies come up with offbeat names or names for products. I can't really talk about. There's some things I can't talk about. I should say that as well.
That's important to know. Well, so you do talk about feedback in this creative process, right?
And indeed.
And what's the most effective way to use this feedback that we would either get from constituents or from the public or from wherever we might be seeking what I would call this feedback loop? Okay, here's my idea. What do you think? Here's it, blah, blah, blah. What do you think? To enhance rather than stifle creative ideas, as you said in the book. In other words, this feedback loop can be used quite positively. How can our listeners use it, and how effective has it been in helping your clients actually achieve success?
Well, I mean, you get feedback from a variety of, you know, from your own group, from your customers, say from upper management. So I guess a couple of things I would say is if you're getting feedback from your customers, I pay great attention to that. And sometimes, you know, as Jobs used to say about ideas, sometimes we customer doesn't even know what he or she wants, and so we're going to create it. So you may pay less attention there. This was Apple of a long time ago. But I think it's important to listen to your customers. When you're working with other people, say in your group, with your bosses, or even in your family, one thing that I stress with individuals is try the creative no. The creative no, that's N-O, not K-N-O-W. And the way it works is if you're, especially when you're in a partnership, if somebody comes to you with an idea and you don't like it, you just can't dismiss it, but you can dismiss it, but it's also your responsibility to come up with a new idea that both people like. And I picked this up from a friend from a long time ago, the playwright Jerome Lawrence. He wrote Mame and The Night Thoreau Spent in Jail and so on. And he worked with his partner in writing plays was Robert Lee. And they often found themselves in this situation where one person would have an idea and another, you know, wouldn't like it so much. And so their deal was is that, again, if you had an idea that the other person didn't like, you couldn't just reject it. You had to keep working and turning it over until and you came up with an idea that both people liked it. Another thing to do is if somebody comes to you with an idea and it doesn't quite fit in, try to give yourself 60 seconds before saying anything negative about the new idea. You know, again, people are reaction. You know, someone says something to you and you react all the time. And you know, if an idea is weird or strange, often your first reaction will be, it doesn't fit in our budget, it won't work. But if you wait 60 seconds, you might be able to create a context where the idea makes some sense, or at least part of it, or at least, develop it a little bit. And so that, you haven't killed the person bringing it as well. So those are a couple of things I would think. But again, getting back to your question, you know, we're getting feedback all the time from a lot of different places, but at least close in with your colleagues, your spouse, your family members, and so on. If you can remember the creative no, what do we want to do for holidays? You know, well, you have to build on those ideas also to wait 60 seconds if an idea is really bad before dismissing it. It's hard to do, but it's a good practice to get into, especially when you're in the early parts of the creative process.
Well, it's sage advice, I think, for people. Regardless, your book is filled with sage advice. Anybody like yourself who's had a book that's been written and sold millions of copies, obviously people are buying.
But I hope it's, in addition to being sage, I hope it's fun. You know, I hope it's practical. I mean, that's the key thing. You know, I hope, you know, it's stuff that people can use. It's been interesting. When you create a product, or in this case, a book, and you send it out into the world, it's interesting to see what kind of reaction you get. And over the years, probably half the, well, I used to get mail, letters, but, the last 20 years, 25 years, it's email and, sometimes a text or two. But the reaction, probably half of it's been from business people, like, we used to with our group and it solved this problem and so on. But even more enjoyable has been the reaction I've gotten from coaches and ministers and high school students who picked up a whack in the side of the head and said, oh, yeah, this is good. And I looked, help me look at my problem in a different way. So it's reached not only a business audience, it's also reached a more general audience. And I've had a lot of past clients, some people in their 40s who would pick up the book, read it, use it in the group, and then they would give it to their son or daughter in college or high school. And, that's also another thing. WAC has been used in a lot of collegiate courses, in entrepreneurship, in design, and psychology, and so on. So
you have quite a reputation that follows you, and it's a good one, and I'm so pleased to have you on the show. Now, to wrap up our interview, I have a question, kind of a final question. You talk about the role of the wise fool. Can you give an example of when you've played this role to challenge conventional thinking effectively. So in other words, if somebody out there was going to play the role of the wise fool, what would that be, Roger?
Oh, I love the wise fool. I mean, I should say, when some people hear the term fool, they think of the crazy, the stupid person. There's two kinds of fools. There's the young fool. Usually that's the person who doesn't know any better, you know, what to do. And then the wise fool, who's been around a while and whose rule generally is to give people a whack on the side of the head, to break set. You know, you get in a group situation, everyone's looking at a problem in a particular way, and it's the wise fool's role. This is what the role he performed at court, to frame an idea in a different way. For example, you know, he might say something such as, if we see a man backwards on a horse, riding backwards on a horse, why do we say that the man's backwards and not the horse? Or, you know, just kind of flip things, you know, on their heads. The wise fool will use humor. I've been talking about this. The wise fool will use the second right answer, the third right answer, looking for things, but try to inject a little humor into it. You know, people can get really, really serious about a lot of stuff. And we've seen this, I don't know, through the pandemic. Well, with the last 5 years, let's say the last 5 or 8 years. And I think there have been times when there's been a call to conform to certain ways of thinking. And I think the wise fool is the one who will challenge that. You know, like, why is this particular administrator or bureaucrat saying this? What if we took a different point of view? What if we challenged that point of view? And I do that a lot. One of my grandchildren was over this morning, and she's 6 years old, and we're out walking around and playing, and I said, what are some funny things we can, you know, see about nature, or how this leaf is doing, or what this banana slug is doing? And, you know, if you had just had that humorous or going beyond the first right answer approach, I think that's a good way to get into the wise fool frame of mind. I think the wise fool encompasses the three things that I talked about earlier on: not falling in love with the way you're already doing things, don't fall in love with ideas, looking for the second right answer, and then using humor, you know, to look at things a little differently. So I'll finish that up by saying I started my business a long time ago, 1977. I was young. I had gotten my doctorate from Stanford in a field called the history of ideas. 60s and 70s were a different time, as you know. And so I was really interested in ideas. And then I went to work at IBM for a couple of years. And the thing that I noticed is that at IBM, all of my clients, my customers, were really smart. They knew what they were doing, but their thinking was really narrow because of the needs of the technology. They had to do things in a certain way. And so I said, I see a need for a service, a set of consultancy approaches that would open up people's thinking, you know, in business. Well, most people in business, when they go back to school, they get MBAs, so they get more of the same. And most people with degrees in philosophy, you know, are off driving taxis or teaching at small colleges, what have you. But I had this interesting combination of having a background in the history of ideas and also having some business experience at a pretty high level dealing with enterprise businesses. So I said, I'm going to create a business to stimulate creativity in business. I'm going to be a fool. I'm going to be a wise fool. And everybody said I was crazy to do that, and you're not going to make any money. But I put the business together in a way that I would help companies, you know, solve problems, deal with issues. I wasn't selling creativity to business. I was selling what creativity did for businesses. In other words, higher productivity, meetings or projects managed in 6 months rather than, you know, 10 months, or new products, you know, 20 new ideas rather than just five. And so I found a pretty good audience, you know, initially with technology companies, but then, you know, around the world. So I've tried to live the wise fool, or embrace that, you know, with my books, my seminars. I mentioned that I've produced 7 conferences in the early 80s, had people such as Bob Metcalf, the inventor of Ethernet, and Steve Jobs, and Nolan Bushnell, who founded Atari, and Bill Gates, and Trip Hawkins, who founded Electronic Arts. and on and on. But on past that, you know, creating apps and software. And for the last, well, almost 20 years, I've been a toy designer. And you mentioned at the top of the program that you have a you had a ball of wax. I mean, this is a product that has been a million seller. It's a creativity tool in a ball. It breaks into 30 different pieces. But I had to learn about how to do that. You know, I've created a variety of others. I guess some of these will show up. But I think that the key thing is to put yourself in situations where you can use the wise fool in you to use your creative abilities, and to keep challenging things. And I think you'll have a fulfilled life. You know, I'm getting to the point. Well, go ahead.
I'm actually glad that Roger Venack took this actual trip down a creativity path, because not that there aren't other people, but you're very well known for what you do. And I want to thank you for being on Insight Personal Growth. And I want to thank you for sharing not only your stories, but actually giving people advice and some ideas about if they get stuck, this is what you should do and how you might want to think. And I'm going to tell all of my listeners, very easy, just go to Amazon. This is the new book. It's the revised and updated version of the book, which is there. We'll put a link to that as well. We'll put a link to Roger's website, so you can actually go up there. You can see some of the toys he's created. You can see some things. You can actually buy these on Amazon as well. These are available, so you can get that with it. You'll get a whack inside of your head. Thank you, Roger Venack, for being on the show. Appreciate it. Appreciate you and all that you're doing and all you've done over the years to help people be more creative and more innovative. Thank you so much.
My pleasure to be with you, Greg. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this podcast on Inside Personal Growth. We appreciate your support. And for more information about new podcasts, please go to insidepersonalgrowth.com or any of your favorite channels to listen to our podcast. Thanks again, and have a wonderful day.